Welcome back to the program. You know, sometimes a place, a family, and a business come inexorably together in ways that combine their history, their fate, and their future. Such was certainly the case here in the Napa Valley with the Mondavis, and so it was the case in Cuba with the Bacardi family, the rum industry, and the history of Cuba. Our guest this morning, Tom Gelton, has combined all of these forces to give us a unique and fresh history of Cuba, the Bacardis, and a look at how their collective history might impact the future of Cuba. It is my pleasure this morning to welcome Tom Gelton. He's a veteran NPR correspondent on international issues, a regular panelist on Washington Week. He's reported from Yugoslavia, where he won the George Polk and Robert F. Kennedy Awards, as well as an Overseas Press Club Award. It is my pleasure to have him here to talk about his book, Bacardi, The Long Fight for Cuba. Tom Gelton, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeff, it's a pleasure to be on your program.
Great to have you here. One of the things that you point out is that we know so little, really, about the real history of Cuba that predates Castro and really have very poor understanding of really the historical antecedents of that nation.
Well, you know, the truth is, Jeff, that we think we know a lot about Cuba, but what we know about Cuba, I find, is sort of contained in a few cliches and rather stale themes, and what we know, it leaves out a lot of rich, complex, fascinating aspects of Cuban history. And what I wanted to do in this book is to write a story, to turn Cuba history into a story that will bring out some of those lesser-known aspects of the Cuban narrative.
And, of course, the Bacardi family, as you write, has been involved in virtually every aspect of this Cuban history going back to the mid-1800s.
That's right. I found that their story and the fascinating characters in the family over a space of 100 years really provided the perfect vehicle for sort of explaining the larger story of Cuba. I mean, I basically tell the Bacardi story here, but in the process of telling the Bacardi story, I think that I'm able to illuminate, all the various phases of Cuban history, the big turning points, the major events. I mean, as it turns out, in one way or another, they were involved at every key point in Cuban history, and sometimes in a direct way, sometimes in an indirect way, sometimes just as witnesses. But you could not read and follow the Bacardi story and not get a sense of what was going on in Cuba over this long period of time. And, you know, you mentioned in the intro the Mondavi story. It sort of is comparable in a sense. I mean, these family epics are just so marvelous at really bringing to life the times and the experience and the color of the period in which they lived.
One of the central themes that runs through this with respect to the Bacardis and Cuba is this sense of patriotism, this sense of nationalism for Cuba, and really the story of Cuban identity.
Exactly right, Jeff. And in fact, I would say that the overall theme of the book is, what does Cuban patriotism mean in different periods of Cuba's history? And the point is that whether you're talking about the 1860s or the 1920s or the 1950s or the 1990s, you know, the idea of Cuban patriotism has a very different meaning. And, the subtitle of this book is The Biography of a Cause. Well, the cause for the Bacardis is Cuban patriotism, but I say the biography of a cause because it's like a living history, a living thing that evolves and changes and is transformed over time. What it meant to be a patriot in the 19th century is something very different from what it meant in other periods of time. The one thing that ties it all together for the Bacardis is that they've always felt that they were patriots, but, you know, it meant something different in different phases of their family life and in Cuba's family national life.
And as the country has changed, so too, you write, has the company changed. And it's also a business story of how a family-owned generational business changes with the times, as the country has.
Yeah, and the Cuba connection, you know, is a common thread. But you can use that thread to sort of measure how the company has changed. I mean, nowadays, the Bacardis are very interested in Cuba, but more from a commercial point of view than from a political point of view. So, yes, this is it still is a family-owned company, even though it's worth billions and billions of dollars and has operations all over the world and is a diversified conglomerate that includes many different brands, not just Bacardi rum, also Grey Goose vodka and Dewar's whiskey and Bombay Sapphire gin. Still, in spite of all that, there is this kind of Cuba connection. But you can sort of trace how this company has evolved over the years, and it tells us something about family companies, about how private companies are different from public companies. You know, you can read this either as a Cuba story or as a business story.
One of the things that's fascinating about the Bacardi family you talk about is that while most kind of generational family businesses might last two generations, three generations, that the Bacardi family is now in its fifth generation. And one wonders how that unique circumstance is somehow tied to the company's ties to Cuba.
I think that it is, Jeff. And I think one of the... You're absolutely right. I mean, the literature about family businesses show that the vast, vast majority of 90% of them or something sort of don't last beyond the third generation. What that often means is that the founder of the company is the one who keeps it together. And once the founder disappears, once he's dead and gone, you know, with each succeeding generation, their connection to the enterprise is weaker and weaker. What happened in the case of Bacardi is in 1960, 100 years after the company was founded, it was expelled from Cuba. And that was sort of a moment of rebirth, in a sense. And Pepin Bosch, who was the chairman of the company at the time, reorganized the company in exile. And in a sense, he almost became the second founder of the company. So it's like the clock started ticking all over again, which is why, in fact, there are sixth-generation Bacardis who are now grown-ups and moving into executive positions in the company. So this is an extraordinary story. I don't know of any family company anywhere in the world that is still such a family company today as Bacardi is, and as big and rich and powerful and successful as the Bacardi company is.
Mm-hmm. One of the things also is how strong some of the family leadership has been during this period of time. I mean, you mentioned Pepin Bosch, but also some of the other leaders going back to the beginning. You spent a lot of time talking about Emilio Bacardi, who was, yeah, I guess, the second leader of the company.
Right, exactly. Emilio was the son of the company was founded by a Spanish immigrant by the name of Facundo Bacardi, who was the one that really came up with the idea of developing a new type of rum, a lighter, whiter rum. And it was really his entrepreneurship and his vision that launched the Bacardi company. But Emilio was his oldest son. He was therefore the first Bacardi born in Cuba, and the first Bacardi that really took his Cuban identity and nationality very seriously. He was actually torn between, you know, his desire to help his father in the family rum business and his own personal interest in Cuba's national struggle for independence. And he is the first Bacardi in whom those two strands, the business strand and the patriotic strand, really come together. So he's just a fascinating character. He's around for many years. He's well known in Cuba as a legendary revolutionary and underground conspirator. He was twice imprisoned in Spain. He was the first Cuban mayor of a major Cuban city, Santiago, after the independence war and the U.S. military occupation. He went on to be a senator. Some people thought he should be president of Cuba. He's also a playwright and a novelist, a writer. So he's a real Renaissance man, you know, not only a famous businessman, but also a politician, a writer, a patriot. So he's a remarkable character.
There's really a sense that he set the stage for what would become the corporate culture of the company, that revolutionary fervor that you're talking about.
That's right. I think that he inspired the other generations to he set the mold, in a sense, set the example. And what he said is that, you know, if you're going to be a Bacardi, you're going to be a Cuban patriot. And I think later generations of Bacardis felt they needed to follow in the tradition of Emilio Bacardi, and even while building up their company, demonstrate a broader kind of civic commitment. I mean, the Bacardis in Cuba in the 20th century were known not only for their business acumen, but for their support for sort of civic causes. They were seen as a very progressive a family, a progressive company, at a time when a lot of Cuban businessmen were corrupt and were allied with dictators and were tax evaders and mistreated their workers. I mean, the Bacardis were really quite exemplary in this with their reputation for integrity and the Bacardi Rum Company was the largest company largest industry in Cuba, wholly owned by a Cuban family outside of the sugar sector. So they represented a sort of a real combination of business and civic leadership in Cuba for many, many years.
And this sense of revolutionary fervor carried all the way through to what is quite surprising, that in fact the Bacardi family supported Castro in his takeover initially.
You know, one of the themes in Cuban history is how much political violence there's been. And when we hear about Fidel's revolution, I've been talking about the revolution of the 19th century against Spain. There was also a revolution in 1933. I mean, this is a country that's been through a lot of revolutions and has experienced a lot of political violence. And unfortunately, there's been a bit of a tendency to kind of go quickly to armed uprisings. When you have a government you don't like, and the Bacardis, for better or worse, were involved in a lot of these uprisings. They were involved in the wars of 1868 to 1878, and then the Second Independence War in the 1890s, and the Revolution of 1933. And you're absolutely right. When Fidel Castro came along with his 26th of July movement in the 1950s to overthrow Batista, and he had his guerrilla fighters up there in the mountains, the Bacardis were buying weapons for him. They were raising funds for him. Bacardi women were knitting stocking caps and gloves for the fighters. They were wholehearted supporters of this revolution, even understanding that it was a violent revolution. I mean, Pepin Bosch was raising money for weapons for these guys. So to them, it was just another, demonstration of their support for progressive causes in Cuba. And then, the next chapter of this, Jeff, is they get their properties are all confiscated, and they go into exile, and they feel sort of that they've been betrayed by Fidel Castro, whom they supported. They feel double-crossed. And what do they do in exile? They do the same thing they've done throughout their life, which is they continue to support armed uprisings. So this time it's an armed uprising against Fidel Castro. They're involved in the Bay of Pigs invasion in the 1960s and other sort of clandestine missions. That's gotten them a lot of bad press. But one of the points that I make is you got to look at this in the whole history of the company, the family. This is what they've been doing for 100 years. They've been getting involved in revolutions.
You know, we see that this connection sometimes with American companies, where once they step foot into the political arena, that there's always the fear that it will have an impact on their business. And we're seeing that as recently as today. To what extent were the Bacardis ever concerned that their political involvement would really impact their business?
That's a fascinating question, Jeff. And the part of the answer to that is that if you really know U.S.-Cuba policy and relations, you see the Bacardi hand in those affairs on many different occasions. But if you just look at the business activity, you see no evidence of it at all. I mean, how many of your listeners even associate Bacardi rum with Cuba? None of their advertising features Cuba. The word Cuban does not appear on any of their bottles. I mean, if you look at a bottle of Bacardi rum, it says established 1862. It doesn't say where it was established. At the bottom of the bottle, it says Puerto Rican rum. That's where most of their rum is produced. So, nothing sort of in their corporate image is linked to Cuba. But privately, the Bacardi family, continues to be deeply involved in Cuba-related issues. But what they seem to have done here, in answer to your question, is they've drawn a hard and fast line between their private activity and their business commercial profile.
And yet they were involved in this battle back in the 90s for the Havana Club label.
Yeah, right. And that's the time that line was sort of erased to some extent. And they've kind of moved beyond that. I actually get the feeling, Jeff, now that they're not sure that was even a good idea. Basically, what happened there is in the 1990s, as Cuba was beginning to open up, the country allowed foreign investors to come in. And one of the first foreign investors to come in was the French liquor firm Pernod Ricard, because they wanted a piece of the Cuban rum industry. They saw Cuban rum as this product that was going to that was going to have a lot of potential. Well, who is the originator of Cuban rum? Who's the one that put Cuba on the map for its rum? It was the Bacardi family. And this drove them crazy to see the French company going into Cuba and picking up, in some cases, even making rum in their old facilities. They just flipped out, and they were resolved to do everything they could to thwart this move by Pernod Ricard into the Cuban rum business. And it's a very complicated story. It has to do with trademark law and all that. But what they basically did is the rum that was being marketed was called Havana Club rum. It was not the old Bacardi product. It was a different rum. Had been a small company in the pre-Castro days. The Bacardis tracked down the Cuban family that originally owned that Bacardi, that Havana Club label, and they purchased the rights to that label, such as they were, and then got Congress to pass a law saying that no rum that was taken over by the Cuban government from a Cuban family could be sold in the United States. I mean, it was a law that was written explicitly to support Bacardi's struggle against Pernod Ricard. But that, yeah, you're right. That was the one example where they allowed their commercial, their business agenda to intersect with their Cuba agenda. But we haven't heard a lot about this. You're right, this was in the 1990s. It sort of has gone away for the time being.
Given the depth of Bacardi's roots at Cuba, given their support, their economic support for Castro's revolution, why were they so betrayed by Castro?
I tracked down, in the course of researching this book, I tracked down a Cuban who was the Vice Minister of Industry in 1960 when Bacardi was expropriated. He was the Vice Minister of Industry under Che Guevara, and he was personally involved in the confiscation of the Bacardi Rum Company. And I asked him that very question. I said, "Look, these guys were your best friends in the business class. They went out on a limb to support everything that you were trying to do. They paid their income taxes in advance. They volunteered to donate. They donated tractors to your agrarian reform program. You couldn't have asked anything more of them than what they gave you." And he said, "You're absolutely right. The Bacardis did support our revolution. They were friends of Cuba. They were an esteemed Cuban family. When we confiscated their properties in 1960, it had nothing to do with them personally. We didn't have anything against them personally, and they shouldn't take it personally. This was a decision to go for socialism. We just didn't want any private enterprise in Cuba anymore, so we nationalized all private companies in Cuba. It wasn't just the Bacardis, and, you know, it was nothing in particular. It was just sort of unfortunate that they were a private firm, and, even though they were Cuban patriots, we had to take it."
What can the Bacardi experience and the attitudes of the Bacardi family today, what can it tell us about perhaps foreshadowing some of the changes still to come in Cuba post-Fidel?
Various things, Jeff. First of all, one of the important things is that exile changes people. The experience of exile marks the sort of the Bacardis from 1960 onward with a different character than the previous 100 years. I say it's kind of an embittering experience. It makes them angry. Their patriotism takes on a more negative form. They've also, of course, become very, very wealthy. They have lived now in the United States or in Spain or elsewhere for the last 50 years. For them to go back to Cuba now, they would not return as the legendary Cuban patriots, even though they still regard themselves as Cuban patriots. That experience of exile has really changed them. And they would go back to Cuba. They would be representative of the exile community. And I think that I actually believe, based on all my experience in Cuba, that there's a tremendous amount of alienation from the Cuban government. There's much less support for the Castro regime among the population than they would have you think. Nevertheless, I also have found that there is a real distrust of these exiles, including the Bacardis, no matter how patriotic they may have been. I think it's going to be very difficult for them to sort of reestablish themselves in Cuba. On the other hand, they have money, they have goodwill, they would like to go back to Cuba and sort of reassociate the Bacardi name with the Cuban cause, and it could take a variety of forms. They could go back in a kind of a humanitarian way and start a foundation and, build houses for people. I just think that the future of Cuba is a big question mark. I've been there a lot. I've spent a lot of time studying it. I don't know what's going to happen. I think it's It's very unpredictable. I think that the forecasts that, you hear from the Cuban exile side or from the Cuban government side have to be taken with a grain of salt. I think this is, we haven't heard the last of this story yet. This is a story, the Cuban story, that has taken so many twists and turns over the last 150 years. I think we're still in for some surprises and adventures here in the coming years.
And there does seem to be some sense of the Soviet example, the former Soviet example, in that there's an awful lot of fear of change, even if it's what we would perceive as positive change after Castro.
Well, I say in my book that some of those people who are most afraid of change are precisely those who want it most. I mean, that sounds like a paradox, and it is, but people live on the edge in Cuba. There's a sense of fragility to their lives, a sense that they are really exposed to, and what this means is that people are risk-averse. They desperately want hope for a new life. On the other hand, they know that that could be a wrenching change, and when you have a lot, when you don't have a lot, you are afraid about even losing what little you have, and that makes you sort of, ironically, it makes you conservative and cautious about change, even though you desperately want it.
Tom Gelton, the book is Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, the biography of a cause. It's just out in paperback from Penguin. Tom, it's been a pleasure. I thank you so much for being with us.
Anytime, Jeff. It's been fun.